Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of Focus today, we'll be talking about Medicare. This is the program that provides health insurance to Americans who are over 65. There are some other people who are included too, but mostly here what we're talking about is retirees. And one thing that we know is over the next couple of decades, the number of people who reach that age is going to increase significantly. Just 3 years from now, the first members of the baby boom generation will be turning 65. By the year 2030, all of them, all 78 million of them, will have reached retirement age. And this very dramatic growth in the number of seniors, coupled with increases in the cost of health care, will pose a serious challenge for the government program that provides health insurance to older Americans. This morning in this part of the show, we'll be talking with Robert Rich. He is director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, and is interested in a number of things, including Medicaid and Medicare, as well as health care policy and regulation, prescription drugs, and universal health insurance access. In addition to his appointment in the Institute, he also has appointments in the College of Medicine, the Political Science Department, and the College of Law at the University of Illinois, and has been here before on the program to talk about this and related issues. Generally speaking, certainly, we've talked about health care delivery and cost and reform here in the United States, and we were just chatting before we got going here. I'm sure we can all expect that it's an issue that will be big during the presidential contest that lies ahead of us here. So as we talk this morning, certainly questions are welcome from people who are listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And we do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people are brief in their comments just so we can keep things moving along. Well, thanks very much for being here once again.
A pleasure, David.
Just to toss out some numbers here, how many people now are there covered by Medicare in currently?
Well, I don't have an exact number to be honest with you, but as you said before, it's all people over 65 years of age, and it's divided into several parts. There's Medicare Part A, which is the inpatient hospital-based care, which all of us have. When we talk about Medicare's entitlement, it means that all you have to do is reach the ripe age of 65, and you're entitled to Medicare Part A, everyone. Then there's Medicare Part B, which is the inpatient part of Medicare, which we pay an insurance premium for. But over 95% of people over 65 take advantage of Part B Medicare. Then there's Part C Medicare, which is the so-called Medicare Plus Choice program, which is the managed care part of Medicare, which far fewer people take advantage of. And then there's the prescription drug part of Medicare, which is Part D, which has become very controversial as well because of the growing price of prescription drugs.
Well, perhaps we could talk a little bit about it. I'm certainly interested in talking about C and Part C and D. Can we talk a little bit about what it is we're spending right now on Medicare and anybody's idea about what is going to happen to that spending as we go here through a lot now, roughly speaking, about the next 20 years, a little bit more, to that point where we get work our way all the way through the baby boom and we have this big increase in number of people over 65.
Let's talk for a moment, if it's okay, with what's changed so much about Medicare. When Medicare was passed in 1965, there were assumptions made about Medicare that no longer are valid. First of all, there was in 1965 a compulsory retirement age. There is no longer a compulsory retirement age. Moreover, life expectancy in 1965 for males was just over 65 years of age, and for females was just over 68 years of age. And so at that time, not only were there fewer people who had Medicare, but the notion was, here's a seamless transition. We're going to make the transition from the day you retire, you're going to move on for your income to Social Security and for your health care over to Medicare. Now, not only are this growing number of people, the 78 million you mentioned in the baby boom generation, which will make this, as I understand it, about 125 million people who are on Medicare, but males now live a little over 78 years on average, and females a little over 80 years on average. And so life expectancy is much greater. With this growing life expectancy, the demand for prescription drugs is much higher because prescription drugs are what helps keep people alive. And so the so-called Medicare Trust Fund is, by all calculations, going to be depleted by the year 2040. And that's not fiction. That's not somebody's delusion. It is that unless something is done, that the Medicare Trust Fund will be depleted and our children won't have a Medicare program to take advantage of, even though they pay a payroll tax every pay period for Medicare.
Yeah. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about Medicare Part C. Now, the way Medicare Parts A and B work is, and do correct me if I got this wrong, but one of the basic things is that you, as a patient, you may choose what hospital you go to and what doctor you go to. So you can go in any
correct.
Place you want.
There's
a sort of a separate issue about how much the procedures that you get actually cost and what Medicare pays, but we'll save that for a second. So you can go any place you want. I think that as people have looked at this cost issue, that some people have said, well, what we would be better off if we could get people on Medicare into some kind of managed care situation. So here, I guess that's the idea behind Medicare Part C.
Correct.
It's a different way of delivering the service. How has that worked? And in fact, can you look at Medicare Part C? And if your interest is cost containment, is that a good model?
Right. It's a complicated question. First of all, let's get some figures here. 85% of people who in the age group 18 to 65 who have health insurance have it through some form of managed care. 25% of people on Medicare have it through some form of managed care. Now, there are at least two major reasons for that. First of all, people over 65 prefer choice, and they prefer a fee-for-service plan, where, as you say, they can go anywhere, any place in the United States, and be reimbursed for whatever they're going to be reimbursed for. We can come back to that issue. The other reason is because managed care, in order to really produce cost savings, has to have a case mix which has the full range of risk, from high risk to low risk, associated with it. And people over 65 years of age are, as we know, among the highest users of medical service. And so there's real reluctance on the part of managed care organizations to get involved with the Medicare population. And they certainly don't like Medicare Plus C because it is the case mixes more people over 65 than less, and they take a bath from a cost standpoint. And so hence this figure of only 25% of people on Medicare on Part C.
Yeah. Well, I wonder which of those two things is more important. The availability of this and the willingness of providers to get into that kind of plan, or that consumers who may be either they're just used to fee-for-service, or they simply say, well, that's the way that I want to go. Which of those two things contributes more to the fact that relatively small percentage of people over 65 are in Medicare Part C?
I suspect that it is more the former, that is to say more people prefer the fee-for-service, but I think the latter would come in big time even if people wanted managed care. The managed care organizations really don't like the over 65 population because they are so costly.
Yeah. So who is anyone pushing to try to get more people into Part C, or anyone continuing to say this is really the way that we ought to be going because it's more effective for cost containment?
President Bush has pushed very hard on Medicare Part C, and I would say anyone whose major objective is cost containment should be doing that, because the one thing we know about managed care plans is managed care plans have been successful in reducing costs.
Yeah. Going back to this issue of providers and their reimbursement, This is a significant issue, at least as if you're a provider, it certainly is, because providers, they know for any given procedure, they have decided how much this is going to cost to provide. And then the government says, well, for any given procedure, this is how much we will give you. And there can be a pretty big spread between what the providers say it costs and what the government will be reimbursing them. How big an issue is that?
It's a huge issue. One of the most important issues in terms of Medicare and Medicare reform. There are three concepts you need to keep in mind here. One of them is real costs. The second is charges. And the third is reimbursement. Real cost is the hardest to get a handle on of what a provider's real cost is. We know what they charge. And then Medicare basically says, on average, we'll pay 65% of charges. And what we know is there's a gap between what Medicare reimburses and the charges. What we don't know is how big a gap, if any, there is between real costs and the reimbursement level. The best guess is that the gap, that the difference between real costs and charges and reimbursement level is about 60 to 70% is what is real costs. And Medicare is tagged at 65%. So they're doing pretty well. As opposed, for example, to Medicaid, which is 45%, where Medicaid reimburses at 45%. And there's no doubt that providers, therefore, are losing money on Medicaid patients. So the reason why this is such a big issue is that when providers, especially hospitals, are operating at a very low margin of profit now, if you will, or very low margin of being able to operate, the difference between 65 and 70% is big time. And so one of the major issues before Congress right now is a mandate to increase that reimbursement level to 70% as opposed to 65%.
Now, healthcare institutions now, I suppose they have a couple of options. They can somehow try to absorb the difference between the cost and the reimbursement. They can also turn to patients and in a variety of ways through charging co-payments and other kinds of fees. They can simply say to the patient, well, the government has paid this much. This much is left over. This is your responsibility.
That's your co-payment.
That's your co-pay. How does that work, and does that end up still leaving people with significant kinds of bills that they've somehow got to figure out how they're going to pay?
Yeah, well, what most people do who can afford it is they purchase supplemental insurance. And the way supplemental insurance works is, and there are many forms of supplemental insurance, says that supplemental insurance will pay 80% of what Medicare doesn't pay. Now, note, however, David, that Medicare first has to make a decision of whether or not a particular service is reimbursable. Not every service is reimbursable. So it's not like the supplemental insurance will pay 80% of charges that are left over, because there may be some leftover charges that aren't certified for reimbursement. So with supplemental insurance, then the consumer is left with usually 20% of what is not been reimbursed either by Medicare or by supplemental insurance.
Yeah. And of course, anybody who's been through this process will know that it's extremely complicated. There are a million forms to be filled out. It can take a very long time when people decide what they're going to pay, what they're not going to pay. And this business of getting bills paid can drag on forever as it goes back and forth. And people have to pay. And I'm sure that it's for individual consumers, individuals, it can be tremendously frustrating and complicated and also expensive, because it may be that they're going to have to pay up front and then get reimbursed later.
Correct. But we'd be remiss in not saying that Medicare is really a very good program. And for the most part, Medicare does an excellent job of reimbursing folks for services. And the other thing that you should note is that Medicare has now created the standard for reimbursement. So more private insurance companies now than ever before use the Medicare standard for their reimbursement levels as well. It used to be the case that private insurance companies had their own standards. Mm-hmm. Medicare would pay its 65%, and many private insurance companies would pay 90 or 5%. That's no longer true. Now, private insurance indexes their reimbursement levels to the Medicare levels.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Robert Rich. He is director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. He's interested in health care policy and in Medicaid, Medicare. We're talking this morning about Medicare. That is the government program that provides health care to senior citizens, people over 65. If you have questions, and we have a couple of people who do, you'd like to get into the conversation, just call us, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers, both of them in Urbana. We'll go first to line number two right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
It's my understanding about Medicare and Social Security that the government, the Congress in Washington, D.C., has borrowed billions of dollars from that fund. They say borrowed, but I say stolen, because I don't think they're ever going to be, it's ever going to be paid back. And if it weren't for that, the fund wouldn't be depleted by 2040. So could you talk about that?
You're absolutely correct. One of the ways in which the federal government and the Congress has balanced, quote unquote, gone into less deficit than we currently are is to have robbed, and I think robbed is the right word, robbed the Medicare Trust Fund and also the Social Security Trust Fund as well. That's true. I think what's not true is that even if they didn't do that, because of the demographics that David referred to earlier, the Medicare and Trust and Social Security Trust Funds would be in trouble, maybe not by 2040, but by 2060 or 2070 as well. So it's still an issue. It's just a matter of how quick the issue is. And I also agree with the caller. I don't think that the federal government has any intention of paying back that money either.
Yeah. So how can we? Is there any way to reverse that and make them pay it back?
I suspect that, yes, Congress has the ability to do that. Congress could say, yes, you must pay it back. Congress could also say, you may not ever do that again, that the trust fund is sacred and you can't do it again. But that would require Congress to raise taxes. And it's unlikely that Congress is going to willingly raise taxes.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thanks. And just to make sure that everybody understands what we're talking about here, Social Security, Medicare are supported from payroll taxes, essentially. People who are not people like you and me, but most working people, also people who are self-employed, they're paying into these funds. And the issue is that until now, we've had more people paying in than we have taking out. So there was a surplus. And the government said, huh, well, here's some money sitting around. Why don't we take that money and we'll pay it back later? The concern is that we're going to get to a point where there will be more people taking out than there are paying in. That's the concern about Social Security, and that's also the concern about Medicare.
That is absolutely correct. And the payroll tax for Social Security is for people who are covered by Social Security, which is not state of Illinois employees, but everyone pays Medicare tax, including state of Illinois employees. And anybody who works pays the Medicare tax. And the theory is that more money will be there than is taken out. And that's the problem.
And I guess it's true that anybody could be in Medicare Part B. That's an elective sort of a thing.
Anybody over 65.
You pay a premium for that, and anyone who should wish to participate in that, they can do that.
And as I said, over 95% of people on Medicare do that.
Yeah. All right. Next, we'll talk with someone in Urbana. Again, this is line one. Hello.
Good morning. Can you tell me anything about the difference of cost of medical services between the United States and countries like Canada and European countries?
Absolutely. I can tell to you in two ways. The United States spends about 16% of its gross domestic product on health care. Canada and Germany, our so-called next competitors, spend 9 to 10% on the gross domestic product. So we're spending far more than any other country. I would note, not only are we spending far more, But unlike those other countries, Canada and Germany, where 99% of the population has health insurance, we have 24% of our population who is uninsured and underinsured.
What caused the difference in expenditures?
The major reasons are we spend more on research and technology than any other country in the world by far. We distribute that technology. People have access to it far more. So, for example, in Germany and in Australia, the ratio of MRIs to people is 1 to 1 million people. In Urbana-Champaign alone, there are 3 MRI machines, not at the university, for 150,000 people, just to give you a feel for that. And we spend more on a per case basis. That is to say doctors are paid more, hospitals are reimbursed more, beds cost more. Those are the major reasons why we spend more money. And then one of the most important reasons is we spend more on the last months, days, minutes of a person's life than any other country in the world. Most other countries ration care, especially for people over 80 years of age. And when somebody is terminally ill in these other countries, they make them comfortable through hospice type of care. We in this country have selected to spend enormous amounts of money in those last minutes, days, and months of a person's life.
To exclude the people over 80 in the question, do the rest of us live better, live longer, whatever, because of all this money? Does the money turn into a better life in some sense?
That's also a really good question. The answer to that is no. If you look at the outcomes in these other countries, by almost any index you want, we do not do better than Canada or Germany. Canada and Germany both do better than us, both in terms of life expectancy and infant mortality rates and almost any other indicator you could pick.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. We will continue. And next, we'll talk with someone in Champaign. This will be line number 3.
Yeah.
Hello.
I know that Medicare is going up a lot because it's doubled for me since I started not too long ago. But it's wonderful. And it's a great program, and it's cheaper than anything else I could do, and I have a supplement and so forth and so on. But to me, it seems like we would spread the cost if we would have universal health care so that we're not spending it. We're taking care of people before they hit 80, not after they're, we're all going downhill, that we take care of them in the beginning. And it seems like if we had everybody being taken care of, we would be more or less like England and Germany, Germany and Canada and so forth and so on. Am I just off base, or why does it seem so obvious to me?
You're not off base at all. As I started by saying earlier, that we're the one industrialized country in the world that doesn't have health care as a right of citizenship, which is what universal health care is all about. We don't do it in this country. Instead, we consider health care to be a privilege, usually associated with employment as well. And I don't think we do it because universal health care is usually associated with government-financed, government-mandated insurance, and we have an allergy towards government-financed and government-controlled and government-run health insurance.
Do you think that'll really change when we get rid of the Bush administration?
No.
Oh, geez. That's discouraging. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, it's part of the problem, I think, perhaps, is that we've had the system we've had for a long time, and that there has been resistance to a government finance system going at least back to the early parts of the last century. And one of the important forces that resisted that was, in fact, the American Medical Association. Now, perhaps many physicians have changed their mind, but for a long time, doctors didn't favor it. Insurance companies probably still don't favor it. They don't want things to change from the way that they are. This is proverbing the, turning the proverbial whatever metaphor that you want to use with a system that's been in this way for such a long time. And one also has to consider people's expectations. The idea that many people who have good health care and who are happy can get maybe not all the services that they want, but essentially they've come to expect a high level of service. Also the idea of someone else saying that, well, you may think that you want this procedure or this service, but we're sorry, you're not going to have it. All of that suggests that changing the system, especially in a dramatic way, is going to be extremely difficult, and we shouldn't expect that to happen anytime soon.
That's absolutely correct. You look at the history, as you say, every time national health insurance has been proposed, you may remember that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, when he proposed Social Security in the 1930s, included national health insurance as part of the proposal. The AMA lobbied heavily against it, and he withdrew that proposal. Presidents Truman, Johnson, Kennedy, Nixon, Clinton have all proposed some form of national health insurance, or at least mandated insurance, every time it's been rejected as well. So I'm not hopeful at all that we're going to move towards a universal health care kind of system. On the other hand, I would say to you that, as I mentioned before, the assumptions that governed Medicare before don't exist anymore. And so one of the things that we're going to have to look at is several. One of them is, should we raise the age of eligibility for Medicare? Some people suggest that we should put it up to age 70, which would save a good deal of money. Should we have higher copayments? Because as one of the callers mentioned, Medicare, and I mentioned also, Medicare is a generous, very good program. Should we income index Medicare, which means that people who are working at the age of 70 and making $150,000 or more don't qualify for Medicare or qualify for a lesser portion of Medicare? Those proposals are all ones that need to be considered. Another one, as you know, David, in Social Security and Medicare, you only pay the payroll tax up to $90,000 of income. There are also proposals which say that you should pay that tax over for all income. So if you did any of those things I just mentioned, you would help with the financial viability of Medicare in a big way. But that's a very political hot potato.
Yeah.
Because the baby boom generation is saying, hey, I've paid into Medicare my entire life. Now you're telling me I'm not entitled to this? And guess what? We vote more than anybody else. We're a powerful lobby, and forget about it.
Yeah. And and obviously also, we've had the same kind of conversation about Social Security. It seems as if that's the same, the prescriptions for dealing with the problem, it's the same sort of things. We raise the retirement age, the age at which you can collect benefits. We will maybe do some means testing. We can index those. So there are a variety of things that the people are talking about doing, essentially the same kinds of things to try to cut down on the number of people who are covered and cut down on the amount of money that we're paying out. And then I suppose also, again, people are saying, well, maybe we ought to raise the taxes, the amount of money that we're taking out of people's paychecks to put into the fund, because there we have the same sort of issue. Fewer people paying in, more people pulling out. Some people, I think, have said, well, given the fact that it's very difficult to change the system that we have, the only thing that we can hope to do is make incremental change and chip away at it at the edges. For example, saying, well, what we really have to do is make sure, let's say all children, we're going to take care of children.
Right.
Or let's target those people who don't, the 40 million people who don't have any health insurance at all. Or maybe look at people at the edges, look at then the youngest people, the oldest people, the poor people. Can you really do it that way?
It's better than nothing is what I would say. And I would say that we're going to have to make some incremental steps. Here. I would mention to you that it's not as if it's rocket science and what needs to be done about the healthcare system. It's a matter of political will. We don't have the political will in this country to do what's necessary in healthcare, be that containing costs, be it making it more affordable, be it broader access to care, be it higher reimbursement levels, be it mandating that everybody has to have health insurance. I find it fascinating, for example, that you can't drive an automobile in this country unless you have auto insurance. We have no trouble mandating the fact that if you want to drive an automobile, you must have insurance. We're not willing to do the same thing with respect to health insurance. We're not willing to mandate that health insurance has to exist. So again, I want to say we know what needs to be done or what could be done. It's not rocket science. It's a matter of the political will to get it done, which hasn't existed.
We're a bit past our midpoint. We have some other callers. We'll get right to you. I'd just like to introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes or more. Our guest is Robert Rich. He is director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the U of I. Also has joint appointments in the College of Medicine, Political Science Department, and College of Law. He is interested in a number of things, including health care policy, Medicare, Medicaid, prescription drugs, universal health insurance access. He's been here before on this program. We've talked about these issues, and pleased to have him here once again. We have several callers who are waiting, and we will get right back to the phones. Next, we'll talk with someone in Champaign, and this is line number 2. Hello.
Thank you. I don't know if you saw program that was on PBS sometime in the last month or so. T.R. Reid went around and looked at national health care systems in a number of countries, Germany, England, I think Canada, Japan, and Taiwan. And, you know, the one thing he identified in terms of, you know, the cost difference that you did not when you were saying why we're so much more expensive is the fact that we have for-profit insurance industry that has a lot to do with the cost in, you know, our country. Certainly, you know, if they're around a third or 30% anyway of, you know, the cost of insurance is going to profits in, you know, the insurance companies and administration and efforts to keep people from getting, you know, payment for various health needs that they have. That's a pretty big part of the cost right there, and you did not identify that when you were saying why are we so much more expensive. Now, I think that, you know, the only way we are going to have a chance of, you know, not running the cost or the having the, you know, the problems with Medicare and Medicaid that we're running into is if we go to some sort of national single-payer system that, you know, there are various varieties of it. You know, they had a lot of different things, you know, different ways of approaching it in these other countries, but they all had the one similarity that they had some kind of single-payer system that took the profit out of the health care and health insurance system and contained costs on pharmaceuticals and that sort of thing. And, you know, I mean, it really ran the gamut in terms of ways of approaching it. All the systems were quite different, but of course, and as you pointed out before, they all had better health outcomes in terms of the overall population than we have.
Let me just say one thing: Germany is not a single payer system. I'm familiar with the the German system very well, and Germany is a system. What's interesting, it's more like ours in it's financed primarily by employers and employees. The difference is that in Germany, it is a mandate that everybody has to have insurance. And the way prices are kept down, even through private insurance companies, is by government regulation of prices. And so profits, therefore, are minimized because of price setting. Prices are also set on prescription drugs as well, so that you can purchase the very same prescription drug for your high blood pressure or diabetes or whatever in Germany or Canada or England as in this country, and you'll pay a much lower price because the national government in those cases have negotiated a bulk rate and they pay less. So the reason why I didn't mention insurance before is because it's not one of the big three that drives our costs in this country, other than the extent that it's built into the cost per case basis that I talked about before. But I don't disagree with the notion that we're not going to get meaningful health care reform unless we ensure in some way that everyone is covered with some basic insurance.
Well, you talked about the idea of you know, mandating that, forcing everybody to buy insurance. But if you're going to do that, then, you know, you have to have some way of forcing the insurance companies to take, you know, people that they don't want to cover and also do it in an affordable way. I mean, you know, with driving, you know, you don't have to necessarily drive. People may disagree with that, but certainly, you know, you can drive safely and not necessarily fall into a high-risk pool. But if you're born with a congenital disease, you know, you're kind of stuck. And if the insurance company is going to charge you, you know, five times as much as anybody else to be insured because, you know, they don't really want to, you know, cover you, then, you know, forcing people to buy insurance is, you know, not much of a solution.
I agree with the caller in saying that if we're going to have a mandate either on employers to offer insurance or individuals to buy insurance, that there has to be some price setting as well. And certainly there needs to be a no pre-existing condition clause as well.
Yeah. I appreciate the comments of the caller. We got about 10 minutes left and I have some others I want to get out to. Just very quickly, I think that one of the arguments that people have made in favor of a single-payer system is that it will, that by reducing administrative costs, you reduce your costs overall, and that employing all of those people who deal with all of those pieces of paper and do everything that they do is very expensive. Is there a good estimate on how much we could reduce the cost of health care if indeed we did go to a single-payer system and we eliminated a lot of that administrative expense?
There's a lot of, if you will, urban myth out there, David, about how much administrative costs drive up the cost. Medicare has a very low level of administrative costs associated with it, somewhere around 1% of it. So if I take that as an estimate of a single-payer system as opposed to around 6 to 8% in private health insurance, so you could save some money there.
Yeah. Right. Let's talk with some other folks, and we'll go next to another Champaign listener. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah. You know, we didn't discuss actually preventive care either. I mean, that's one thing about Medicare really doesn't do much in that area.
Absolutely correct. Medicare doesn't do much.
And what happens is that, again, if we had a system getting people younger you know, more follow-up and all that, I think we could do a better job. What if, you know, the premiums have been going up pretty much on Part B. What if all that, I've always wondered, what if that money was, rather than insurance company was sent to Medicare, you know, in other words, you had A and B, you know, what would happen then?
I think it would be an administrative nightmare for the Center for Medical Services in some way, because they would then be forced to get in to reimburse hundreds of thousands of providers that for outpatient care, because inpatient care is a more focused effort. Outpatient care is many, many more providers. So if the premiums were then shifted to the Center for Medical Services, it would be a administrative headache at least.
Okay. And then finally, which is really, an aggravating issue, is Part D. I always felt that was a giveaway to win an election, quite frankly. What's your comment on that? I mean, I know that the pharmaceutical industry has tremendous power, and I think the prices should have been negotiated. But anyway,
I agree with you fully there. I think that the Congress passed up a real opportunity there. Because Medicare has so many people involved with it, I would have preferred to see Congress say, we're going to do what other countries do. We're going to negotiate prices. The Center for Medical Services is going to negotiate prices with the pharmaceutical companies, and we're going to drive down the cost of prescription drugs by doing that. I think that for political reasons, ones that you mentioned, we didn't do that. I still think that's what needs to be done. If we want to fix Part D, we're going to have to go into negotiated prices.
Well, excellent program.
No, thank you. Well, Part D, this is the coverage for prescription medication. It's been in effect a little over 2 years. It came right at the beginning of 2006. There was a lot of controversy about it at the beginning because some members of Congress complained that they were misled about the cost, how much it was going to cost. In fact, they were told it was going to cost X amount of dollars, and in fact, it cost more
double.
Than that.
Only double.
I think that there also was some question about would this do anything to control the cost of prescription drugs? I think that it's the case that someone looked at it and that the cost of prescription drugs after this went into effect actually went up.
Yes, correct.
What's now going on with Part D, and are there people in Congress who are saying maybe we ought to be doing something with this, making some changes?
Well, there's certainly people in Congress who are saying we need to make some changes in Part D because Part D is very complicated. Anybody who's tried to enroll in Part D knows that you have so many choices, so many plans, so many different exceptions and what's in, what's out, that it's very hard for even somebody who's an expert in healthcare to negotiate through this. And so I think Congress is considering at least two or three things. One of them is streamlining the choices and making it far more transparent as to what's involved. And secondly, as I mentioned already, most importantly, is centrally negotiated prices, of saying to the prescription drug industry that we're going to buy in bulk and we're going to buy for a given price, and it's going to be far less than you currently make.
Let's talk. I guess maybe that was our last caller. If we had somebody else who gave up on us, I'm sorry. Other callers are welcome. Certainly, we have about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Robert Rich. He is director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs here at the University of Illinois, and healthcare policy is a major focus of his. He's been here before on the program to talk about these very issues. And 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. But just fairly recently on the program, we had someone, and we were talking about the federal budget, and really what we were concentrating on in that particular conversation was the discretionary part of the budget. And we were talking about earmarks and this whole business of how sometimes it's difficult to figure out who's sponsoring what legislation and where money is going and so forth. But one of the things that we mentioned just in passing, I suppose, at the beginning was that there are big chunks of the budget, the federal budget, that are not discretionary. And here, that's what we're talking about here. And it's Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, service on the debt. Those things, they have to be paid no matter what. You got to pay those first, and then you can worry about the other money. And I wonder to what extent, particularly now that we are moving up to a presidential election, how much discussion there is going to be on this issue of what do we do about these parts of the budget where the bills must be paid, and as we have discussed, where we know that the cost of the programs, if we do nothing, the costs are going to get to the point where it's simply not sustainable.
There's no doubt that Social Security reform and Medicare reform and Medicaid reform are going to be issues in both the national elections and the state elections, basically because of the fact these are all entitlements. And as entitlements, they're not predictable how much they're going to cost each year. So we can't say at the beginning of a given year how much we're going to pay this year in Medicare and in Medicaid, because it depends on how many services are actually expended and taken advantage of. So it's one of the reasons why these are runaway costs is as the number of medical services go up, so does the cost go up.
Ottawa is our next caller here on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes. I'd like to make 3 points here. The first man that started Social Security was Roosevelt, and he was the first one to borrow from it. And he's the one, he borrowed most of the money for World War II off of that. Number two is research. We do all the research. No wonder Germany and Canada have cheaper insurance, because they use our research that we pay for. And number three is, if health care, universal health care, was so great, why are our clinics in this country so packed with people from Canada coming here to get treatment because they can't get in there before they would have died? So they come to Mayo Clinic and all the Kettering and such and all up in the Northwest. And so I'm not in favor at all of universal health care unless we can have the same care that the Congress gets. Kennedy's laying in the hospital for 3 days or five with a seizure. If I'm on Medicare, they wouldn't keep me 5 days.
Well, comments?
I'd simply say that that Europe also does research. So does Japan do research. So we're not the only ones doing research, although we do spend more on research. And I think that the number of people coming to the United States for care from these other countries are the very rich, who can, the very wealthy, who can afford to do it. And as the caller says, who don't want to wait for any lines. Mm.
There, I suppose there are some people who argue that we do have a problem here in that there is research done in this country that is publicly funded, but then eventually some private interest manages to make money off of that, and it's somehow that's not right. Do you see that same thing happening in other countries?
It's especially true in the prescription drug area, though I would say to you, in the prescription drug area, the actual costs of developing a prescription drug are borne primarily by the pharmaceutical companies as well.
Yeah, and that is part of the argument that they make about when people complain about the cost. That's their argument. It says, well, we've spent all this money developing these medications, and we may indeed spend money on something that doesn't pan out, so somehow we've got to recoup our costs.
That's the argument. The only thing I would say is that I'd be, again, in favor myself of more independent testing of drugs that the taxpayers pay for, and combining that then with some more price regulation as well. I think that would be a more efficient system and probably one that has more social justice associated with it.
One more call here at least, line number one. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I noted your point that Medicare costs 1% for administration, and I wonder, has anybody considered generalizing this, using it for the whole country and making it mandatory?
There's certainly been proposals, none of which have passed Congress.
And what's the opposition? The insurance companies don't want to do this because it would cost them money, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. So it's really the insurance companies that are opposing it.
It's the insurance companies. It's, in many cases, some provider associations as well. And it's also, I would say, politically, from Congress's point of view, that we place a lot of emphasis in this country on private sector innovation and private sector domination, and this would take away from that as well.
I see. Well, that's too bad. Okay, thank you.
All right. Somebody wants to call real quick. We can get him in. We have maybe about 2 or 3 minutes left. Well, given we've talked about the dimensions of the problem, and we've talked also about politics and the way that politics place limitations on perhaps what we might do, what do you think, given that, is reasonable to expect and within, say, let's just say, one way or another, we're going to have another president. We're going to have another administration. And they are, I would expect they would perhaps take some different approach to this than what we've seen before. What's likely to happen? Or what's at least, do you think, doable, again, given the fact that there are forces that are resistant to changing the way that we're doing things?
I think the most feasible, from a political standpoint, of getting it done is, one, raising the eligibility age. I think that's one. The second one that I think will be done is higher co-payments for individuals based on their ability to pay. I think what's not going to happen is a total income indexing, because that would take away the entitlement. And I don't think that the American people are going to allow the entitlement to be taken away. But I do think raising the retirement age and raising the co-payments are likely to happen. And I think some reform of prescription drug plan is likely to happen as well.
And just to jump over to something different, but where the concerns are parallel, and that would be Social Security. We talked just a little bit about this, and about also the fact that here we essentially have the same kind of issue, more people taking out than paying in, and some people have talked about the same sorts of things, raising the age at which you can qualify for benefits and tinkering with who gets benefits and how much. Do you think that's also going to happen?
I think that what's most likely to happen in Social Security is raising the amount of tax that's paid. That is to say that it won't be limited at 90. The cap will be raised from 90,000 to 120 or 150 as opposed to unlimited. There are some proposals there which say everybody pays more, and everybody pays on everything they earn, because right now it's only up to $90,000. I think what's likely to happen in Social Security is the cap will go up to 120 or 150.
All right. Well, we will try and keep an eye on these things. I imagine we'll have an opportunity to talk again. Thank you very much.
I appreciate it.
Our guest is Robert Rich. He is the director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs here at the University of Illinois. A lot of interesting information, by the way, on their website on this issue and many other issues. And if you're interested, just go to their site. Go to igpa.uiuc.edu or just put in Institute of Government and Public Affairs into your web browser, and I'm sure that you can find it. And you should take a look and see what they have there on their website.